Welcome to episode 162 with Lori McKenna. You commented my little Big Town sign that I have in here.
Yeah.
And I only have...
I like them all, but that one sticks out to me for some reason.
Because, yes, that's right. Because you are the writer of Girl Crush. I only have signs in this room that I... Because I don't... Doing my job, people will go, here's a plaque for everything. Songs I've never heard. Here's a plaque.
Really?
Yeah, you know, people just want to give you stuff.
People love you, Bobby.
No, it's not about that. People will like, hey, if I give you something now, maybe you'll do me a favor later, that kind of thing, right? You know, you get
it. Sometimes I think that happens, but sometimes people just like you.
I don't know about that. My point is, there's only like six or seven, and the Girl Crush was one because I loved that song. And that, in my story of being in Nashville, that's the first like song that I got in trouble for.
Mm-hmm.
Me, and it was a real like I had to pop the film of because we just went through it in different ways. You wrote the freaking song.
Yeah. I don't know. You know what? I am not educated on how any of this works still.
Really?
And I didn't know you got in trouble until I think I heard you talking about it on one of these podcasts, maybe with Karen or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think like there was mention of it, but I don't know how radio works. It's so confusing to
either.
Me.
Don't
tell me that.
I don't know really how it works either. I just kind of do it my own way. That's why I get in trouble so much.
Well, people love it. I mean, that's good for all of us if you get in trouble, because if you get in trouble, then you're playing songs that, you know, people wouldn't hear otherwise then, right? Isn't that the point?
Yeah. You know, and the super quick version is, before the record came out, the whole album, I think they were on Day Drinking was the first single from that record.
Yeah.
If I'm recalling. And I was with Kimberly the night before. We were in New York, and she said, you're going to love this Girl Crush song. The record hadn't even come out. So the record comes out that day, and I play it, and everybody gets so upset because it was the lesbian song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, one, I also like it when people get upset because it means it's reacting.
Okay.
As long as it's not like homophobic or racist, and that's a different kind of upset. But if people are upset because of an emotion, I'm like, okay, there's something here. Like, I've scratched something.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And so people were upset, and I thought, well, first of all, it's a great song. I didn't even know you then. Is the fun,
no.
You know?
No.
And then my company goes, whoa, everybody's pissed. We have to test the song. We've never done this in research. We have to test it just for your sake. And so they did all this research on me and the song, and it came back mostly positive. And then that's kind of where the wheel started. Then I became just belligerent. And then it all happened, and then I sat back, and then you know, Karen, Kimberly, Jimmy, Philip took over, and the rest is history. But that's why it's in here, because that, to me, it set a precedent in my company that it was,
wow,
oh, this guy's nutty, and if he has a song that he loves, he's just going to play it. Because it wasn't the single when I started playing it.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they weren't even ready for a single yet.
And
I don't know.
And who knows? You know, it's all revisionist history at this point, because the song has lived a wonderful life.
What I learned about that song is everybody has like, they'll attach what they're most passionate about to a story when it is a story that applies to lots of different people. And that song, to, I think, us as writers, our thing was, people aren't listening. Like, you don't listen to the whole song anymore. You know what I mean? Like, are we only giving a song a verse and a chorus? You know, and some songs, you know, you have to, you know, I know you love songs like that. You know what I mean? That you have to like unwind and sort of listen to the whole thing before you know what's going on. And I think the judgments that song got were from people that weren't giving it a true listen to say, oh, wait a minute, are they trying to, you know?
I think even there was no listen. I think it was title even.
Oh, maybe so. Maybe so.
Because
I hadn't thought of that.
You
yet.
Hear Girl Crush. And then a female voice singing it, and you
true.
Go, oh, she's talking about, it's got to be a lesbian song.
Oh, I never even thought of that.
Where if Jimmy comes on, or Phila comes on and start to sing it, and it's, I think it's a whole different ball game. So, and again, this is also the environment when things started to shift where, it, just in my landscape of, you know, I just wanted to play good songs.
Yeah.
And I was playing songs that weren't singles. And that was weird for everybody.
That's amazing.
Anyway, we were just talking about that before it came on. It's so good to see you. Like, you're one of my favorite people in the whole world.
You're so good to me. I appreciate that so much.
I'm not good to you. I just really...
The fact that you listen to what I do...
I love your music as an artist. You know, every time you come to town, I'm like, if you have something, come play on my show.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I mean, Luke Laird was just talking to me about that the other day. We did a writer's round. And he said, you should do I Want Crazy, because remember when you did it on Bobby Bones? I did like the housewife version of like the chorus. I'm like, I can't play that song. And he's like, well, you did it on Bobby's show. It's so cool.
You're one of the only people who, because a lot, everybody comes through my show, right? To play it. And so, but whenever I say that you're coming through, I have friends that reach out and go, hey, I know we haven't talked in 4 months, but can I come sit in the studio? And
no, that's not true.
The last time you were in, there were two on the couch. And
that's and everyone else is like, who?
You are the artist's artist.
Oh, good. That's not, I mean, I'm the luckiest person you've ever met, is what I am.
I don't think you can get lucky that many times in a row.
Well, now that I know so many great writers, so back to Girl Crush for 1 minute. All I did was said that title to Liz Rose and Hillary Lindsay, and Hillary Lindsay sang the first four lines of that song, and just as they are, exactly how they are. And she said, you mean like that? And so Liz and I looked at each other, we're like, had nothing to do with me other than me saying I want to write a song called Girl Crush.
But had you not said the words Girl Crush, the inspiration wouldn't have fallen over to Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying you're lucky. You're just bouncing it off.
Well, I think what's happened is I've put in the work, and so now when I come to Nashville, because I write alone at home a lot, but when I come to Nashville, I get to be in the room with great writers, and there's so many obviously in this town, but I get to be with great writers that understand what I like, and you know what I mean? And so I find myself a little bit more in those moments where I can be lucky like that.
So humble. So humble. You know, I guess right before, because I would say if you and I see each other, we definitely stop and talk. Like, yeah. I say we have a pretty good professional friendship, even more so than professional. Like, we will actually have a conversation, a good talk. But before that happened, I remember Tim McGraw going, Bobby, you're going to hear this song from Lauren McKenna on my record. And I was like, all right, everybody says it, right? Everybody has something that they're like, it's the next thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like, no, I'm not kidding. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, because Tim doesn't say that often. Mm-hmm. He won't go, you know, this is the thing.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, I promise you. He goes, it's not even the single right now, because he had another single. He goes, this is the song that's going to change it for me. And I'm like, okay, Tim. And then freaking humble and kind. It changed the whole thing.
I mean, another perfect example of me being lucky, though. I mean, because Faith, the reason I have a job in this town is because of Faith. And because I put a record out, and she heard it through Missy Gallimore and Melanie Howard. Well, actually, my friend Mary Gaucher, who I grew up in the Boston community playing shows with. And I didn't leave my house with music until I was like 28 or something like that. And Mary's just a little bit older than me. And I would show up in an open mic, and Mary would be there. And we'd be like 10 years older than everybody else in the room. And I'm like this like housewife, and everyone else is like in college, you know. Mary and I would be like the two old ladies there. And we kind of came
old
up
ladies
together.
At 28.
Yeah, but you know, when everyone else is like 15, it seems that way. And so Mary played, you know, my stuff for Melanie Howard. Melanie Howard played it for Missy Gallimore, and then Missy played it for Faith, and that's why, you know, how I got a publishing deal. It's like, looking back now that I know a little bit how it works, it was like I won the lottery. You know what I mean? And so, you know, the songwriting lottery, that I had an in like that right away in this town. And then, but Faith and Tim have just been like champions for me ever since.
Yeah, it's wild, the Faith thing. Your first cut was a Faith cut, right?
Yeah.
First ever cut was?
Well, she cut, for Firefly, she cut four songs. And three of them made the record. One was like a bonus track, but it was Fireflies and Stealing Kisses, which I think was a single. And then If You Ask. And then she cut a song called Lone Star that was like a bonus track. I've had a lot of bonus tracks.
When you get the Target exclusive,
yeah, I love
writers
that.
Talk about, they're like, we made the Target exclusive, which,
yeah.
And this is it. This is, because I have all of them. I've got the whole library pulled. Right? Sometimes I'm just leading you into things because I got it ready for you.
Oh, I love it.
So this gets introduced to Faith, and she says, hey, I love your song. Like, how does that first conversation happen?
So what happened was I put out this record called Bittertown, and the reason I know these dates is rare, because I never know dates, but my son David was born May 10th, 2004. So I know it was 2004. And I put this record called Bitter 10 out, and it had most of those songs on it. And Mary, over the summer, I think at some point, played it for Melanie Howard. Melanie called me like August and said, I want to pitch your songs around town. Is that cool? And I had been here once. I did a round at the Bluebird, and it was probably like 2 years earlier, like 2003 maybe. And I never listened to country music. I didn't grow up listening to country music. I didn't know much about it. And my husband and I came home, and like a month after that first trip, I was like, hey, man, are you listening to, like, the country radio station now? And he's like, it just, it, like, got us. Both of us were, like, hooked from kind of that moment on. And she called, and she's like, you know, I'd love to pitch your songs around town. And I was like, that would be brilliant. I don't know what that means, you know. Pitch away. And then by Thanksgiving, Faith had cut the songs. So I don't know. I think Faith, the story I heard, by that point, Faith had cut a bunch of songs for that record. That record came out the following, August. So about, you know,
2005.
And, you know, it was called Fireflies, and all, you know, the, for those songs to be on there, it was, the first song I heard, you know, coming out of Faith's mouth was Fireflies. I went to Missy's house and she played, you know, I sat down and she played it for me, and I was not emotionally prepared for what it did to me. It literally... And looking back now that I kind of understand where I was at that point, you know, my husband and I had five kids, and I'm just like, still, I still do this. I'm doing little shows, making records, and, you know, he's a plumber. He works for the gas company, and we get all these kids. And I swear when I heard her sing Fireflies, I just broke open. And it was really my first experience of just like tears of joy, but it seemed so sad. Like it looked sad, I think, on the surface, but it was just like this weight had been lifted off my shoulder, and I knew like I could keep making music.
So you're making music and they hear your record a bit. Did you want to be an artist and move to town?
I did have a record deal because of Faith, you know, I did end up making a record on Warner Brothers, but I kind of always knew that I wasn't probably going to move here. My kids were all in school, you know, my husband's job, my family. I'm super tight with my family. And so I didn't think I would ever move here. And I knew I didn't want to be on the road the way, you know, these artists, they,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it is a hard life.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just didn't, I knew I couldn't do that. When Tim and Faith did Soul to Soul in 2007, I went out with them for about 5 weeks, and I had three of the kids with me. And I loved that. You know, I knew I could do it in little tiny little pockets, but I couldn't put in what these artists, you know, give every night to their art. You know, I just, the songwriting part of it is like, I'll be doing that until, you know, they peel me, peel the guitar away from me.
A lot of my friends will go write with you. They'll go up to near Boston where you live.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm going to go write with Laurie. And so... And you just, they go to your house.
Yeah, we just sit in the basement.
What? So walk me through that. So, and they knock on the door, and you answer, and you have guitar on.
I wear a guitar.
You're already riding. Well, how does that work?
Just have a G chord playing as the door opens. We you know, as long as you like children and guitars and dogs. Basically, we have so many dogs right now, but. We just sit in the basement and write. I don't write when I'm by myself. I don't write in the basement, but I have a little writing room in the basement. And what I found was people, I think if you write in Nashville every day and you're such a part of this community, which, you know, I come once or twice a month and I love it, love it, love it, love it. But if I did that every day, I think I would, you know, want to take a trip somewhere else and sit in a different room too. But I think people, if they're playing up in my neck of the woods, they'll come by, or if sometimes I'm really lucky and I'll just have someone that will come up for 2 or 3 days and just, you know, we write literally, you know, write songs, Panera Bread, go to dinner, drop them off at their hotel, next day write songs, Panera Bread. It's like all we have. So it's like we just write and write until they have to take a plane home.
Anytime that either my group or I do comedy and someone will be opening, and we go up to into the Northeast or even to Boston, a couple of them would go, all right, Lori, I'll see you tonight. We'll be back for the show. I'm like, all right, good luck. That's awesome. Yeah. And, you know, you talk about writing alone, which you, and I think that maybe you've said this, other people said, like, you started like writing little prayer, like alone in the kitchen. Is that what, where it started?
When the kids were little, I would just like pick while they were, you know, putting them to bed, I would for years I sat, it was kind of strange when I think about it, I would just sit in their rooms. The first house we lived in, the three oldest boys all slept in the same bedroom. It was just like, it was a two bedroom house, but one of the bedrooms was really big, so all the boys were in there. And I would just sit and play guitar until they all fell asleep. I don't know how they ever did it, to be honest. I didn't think about it. And then, you know, it was like your life changes, like my pattern of writing changes for a while. When they were all in school, like I'd have better, easier time in the morning, like start off right after I drop them off at school and then sort of work through the day. When I still do that sometimes, my two youngest are homeschooling right now, so it's a little different. But Humble and Kind, for example, it was like I just sat in the same chair from like 8 a.m. until, you know, probably 8 p.m. And I just pick away. When I'm writing by myself, it's best for me to like work on it, like do a load of laundry, come back, work on it. My husband's coming home, I sing it to him, you know, and then make dinner. And my brain works kind of well that way.
I love your version of Humble and Kind. Love it so much.
Well, McGraw made that song so much better. He really did. It's funny because he always credits me for the phrasing. And we did this talk together, the two of us, in front of an audience. And they played the work tape, which neither one of us had listened to in a long time. And he had just gotten through like saying, oh, God, I just copied the work tape. And then we listened to it. And I'm looking at him like, no, you didn't. This is way better. I copy him now. It's funny.
Can you play some of her Humble Hands? So good. So did you record this version that I'm hearing right now before or after Tim?
After.
Okay.
After, because that was on The Bird and the Rifle.
Which is a great record, by the way.
Thank you. And the version McGraw has is just my iPhone. And I had just written it. And it takes me a minute sometimes to get phrasing and to sink into the song and to sort of, like, I actually changed the line. His version, the last line says, you know, when you get where you're going, don't forget, turn back around. And by the time I got to it, I realized I couldn't fit all those words. So mine just says, turn right back around. But it's a small little detail. But that's for a long time when I wrote a song, I would even have to play it to an audience a lot before I really knew the song. Or sometimes it still happens where I'll play, if it's a new song, I'll have to play it for an audience and then sort of find out if I like it or not. Sometimes
you need to play it to them to see if you like it.
Sometimes.
What are you looking for though when you're playing something for you to see if you like it?
I think it's like, I actually, when I thought about this like years ago, I think if I was to describe that, I would think, oh, I'd sort of be looking for their approval. And now I think what it is I'm just sort of looking for my comfort level in the song. Like, am I comfortable singing every word of this song to these, you know, in front of somebody versus just by yourself? It's a very different thing. So it takes me a little bit to wrap my head around them sometimes.
With art, obviously impossible to predict any sort of success or failure. Mm-hmm. I think it's the beauty in art.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
With Humble and Kind and with Tim cutting it, did you feel like that there was something special to his version and what he was saying about the song? Because again, he comes to me before the record's even out and it's like, Bobby, this song's going to be massive. Did you feel like it could do that?
It's funny because I didn't know exactly. I didn't know that he was going to cut it, to be honest, for a little bit. And it's funny because I think he had it for like a month and then I don't know if I saw him or I don't know exactly what happened, but he was like, yeah, I'm cutting that song. It's like, oh, thanks. I didn't know, you know, nobody told me. And then once it was cut, he was going to make the video. And when the video came out, they sent me like a rough of the video. And I thought, what is going on? Like, how can this possibly be the video? You know, cause it's so worldly. I always tease and say, I should give him some co-writing credit on that song because he really sees it and brought it to a way different place than I still see it as such a simple little, it's a very simple song. Every line has to rhyme with kind. It's like the easiest rhyme. It's a very simple form. You know, each verse ends in the same line and I still see it as like this tiny little thing, you know, that that I wrote for the kids. And I do remember when I was writing it at one point questioning myself, like, oh, is this preachy? And then I thought, well, who cares if it's preachy? I'm writing it for five children. So if anybody thinks it's preachy, I'm just going to say, well, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to my kids. But he just saw it in such a bigger way. And when the video, when they showed me the video, I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, he's, you know, this is a real far reach for the song. And he just did it. It was amazing to me. It's amazing to me what, I really feel like it's almost two different songs when we sing it.
Do you, and are you able to see, as they would say, the forest from the trees, because you're so close to it, you wrote it, mm-hmm. you've been in the process watching Tim grow with it, but have you been able to see it affect like a mass amount of people as just a message?
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing about music is, and again, that whole luck thing that I'm talking about, it's like, I feel like any sort of creativity, probably people of all, like you said, all kind of art, all kinds of art. If you are, if you keep yourself plugged into it and you like believe that you can do the work if it lands on you.
Whenever I look at like all of your songs, like my favorite, I think one of my favorite songs you've ever written is the Brandi Clark song, Three Kids,
oh,
No
man.
Husband. I love it. This is like, you know why? And I was thinking about this, like why certain songs hit me. Mm-hmm. I think because like my mom raised me alone.
Yeah.
For a long part of her life.
Yeah.
And she had two kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear this song from Brandi Clark. And I know you wrote it with, I was just like, this song, like, at my core, you know how songs can just almost grab your foundation and just like shake it a little bit?
Yeah.
This one does that, Lori.
Oh, well, I love this song. I'm so proud of this song because what happened was we were writing at Universal that day, and I was in like the Mel Tillis room, and I got there early, and I was waiting for Brandi, and I hadn't seen her in a while, so I was just like totally stalking her online, and I just like opened up YouTube or something and was just watching Brandi Clark videos, you know, from people in the audience filming things, and she was in a writer's round, and she was introducing one of her songs. I forget what song it was. And she was describing the woman that she wrote the song about. And she's like, you know, she's like, you know, like, I think it was funny because whoever it was, strangely enough, had five kids. Because what she said was, you know, like, da, 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 this girl, five kids, no husband. And she went on. And I was like, oh, my God. And so she walked in. I was like, hi, we have to write a song called Five Kids, No Husband. But it can't be five kids because I have five kids. And then everyone will think I divorced my husband. So it has to be like a different number. And then we did realize that we both had really close friends that had three kids and no husband. So I love that character, though. Like, that's another gift of music. Like, you write a song all day, you know, with your friend like that, and you develop that character, right? Like, she's not exactly a specific person, but we both loved her by the end of it. You know what I mean? And
I felt like I knew her.
Yeah.
And from listening to the song, and also from knowing, like, that's my people. That's who I grew up with.
Yeah. And there's so many people. And Brandy's so smart because she's the one that said, I forget the very ending of it.
I'll sing the whole thing back. All right. And a one, two.
But when she said, you know, like how, like these people, what's the very end of it? She's a mom and a daddy and a taxi driver. How's it go? The end line is just, it's all branding. And it was like, at first when she said it, I was like, oh my God, I wouldn't have thought that. And it's, but those women get so many people through this world, and it's so, and dads too, you know. I grew up with a single dad, you know what I mean, but it's like the single parent thing is no joke, and I think we both loved that character by the end of it.
Did you find the line, Mike?
She's a mom and a dad and a taxi driver.
What's after that?
When the baby's sick, she's an up all nighter, a hand and a shoulder and a referee, a real life hero if you ask me.
Thank you. And Brandi said that, and I was like, oh good Lord, like, that's it. Like, there's nothing better than that in the whole world. Like, you've just explained it, you know, like.
Yeah, it was like you guys wrote a song about my mom for part of her life. And when I heard it, I was like, God, I told Brandi too. I like hugged her and I was like, this is, and I love Brandi too.
Yeah.
So it's also loving Brandi and how just like pure Brandi is.
Yes, 100%.
And then hearing her sing such a pure song.
Yeah.
That, and then I'm a huge Jillian Jacqueline fan.
Yeah. Oh man. Like, yeah. Love her.
Love her.
Yeah, her, she's the best.
Again, talk about someone who is as authentic as can be.
Yeah.
And two of my favorite songs, one of her last songs on her last part, Sad Girls. Come on. You guys wrote this?
Yeah. That was a moment. You know, we wrote that with Topher Brown and both those songs, God Bless This Mess and that song, were the, like the first two songs the three of us wrote together. And she is... because what happened with this song is, you know, I remember saying, like, you know, and you can't jump out of the car. And it's like when someone just repeat, like, we'll just say that. You can't jump out of the car right now. You know what I mean? It's like that's always the best thing rather than trying to fluff it up or find a different way to say it. And I love it when songs are conversational like that. And she just, she's so honest. And then, of course, her voice is just amazing.
Yeah. When I look, because I know a lot of your massive hits.
Massive hits.
Oh, well, don't massive play like hits. You know, massive hits. But when I started to look through, I started to go, oh, all my favorite people have all my favorite songs with Lori as well that just weren't like big radio songs.
Yeah.
You know, songs that I would listen
That's
to.
That's so cool.
Because for me, I hear things on the radio all the time. Mm-hmm. You ever think, mm-hmm. you hear something 10,000 times, it just starts to be white noise at a point. You know, a song that I love that I felt kind of got robbed was When Someone Stops Loving You. I don't know why that didn't work.
I don't know either. It was Grammy nominated,
it
though,
was.
As you know. But, and just being able to hear Jimmy. You know, Jimmy has one of the best voices, you know, in the whole world. And obviously, I love those people so much. And they are, like, real dear friends to all of us now. And to just have, I wrote that song with Chase McGill and Hillary Lindsay, and that was like the second song of the day. I forget what the first one was, but that was the second song of the day. And again, it was like, I said the title, and Chase was like, I hear what that song's supposed to sound like. And just to have them, you know, sing it and have someone that you love so much sing that song. And we were shocked, to be honest, that it was nominated for a Grammy, but we were just, we had a ball going out there and it was nice to be there knowing that you wouldn't have to make a speech because we knew that, you know, that there...
Who ended up winning?
Casey, Space Cowboy.
You didn't think you would win?
You know what's so great? No, we knew we would. Like, I actually felt like it would be a little bit of a shock if we did. But we were so thankful to be there and spend time with Little Big Town. And Chase was there for... Break Up in the End as well. But
cool.
You know,
yeah.
So great about going to the Grammys with your Nashville community is the pre-telecast, you know, there's no seating. There's no assigned seating. And they all sit together. It's the best thing. Like, the Americana and the country people, like, all sit together. And, like, and Shane and Luke, who won, for Casey wasn't there because I think she was in rehearsals, but that won for Space Cowboy, were, like, right in front of us. And then, you know, they run up and Luke makes his speech and we all they both did a great speech. And Hillary cried for like 10 minutes straight after. Like, we're genuinely so happy for them. And everybody was. It's just that there's something crazy special about this town. And I know I don't live here, so I can't be a true judge of it because I'm an outsider. But it's real. I don't see it happening anywhere else but here, the community here.
When I go and work in Los Angeles, if I'm doing some television projects, mm-hmm. First of all, like, I think here, I'm normally nice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, everybody's everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
But I'm a nice guy. I would say I should get a nice guy award. I'm just a dude. I go to Los Angeles, I'm freaking Pope Bobby. They think I'm the nicest human ever.
Oh, my God.
So, first of all, there's a sensibility that we are taught and grow up with that is normal to us, but I don't know if we appreciate how... like gracious and nice we really are until we mm-hmm. get around people that aren't, right?
Yeah.
And so this is point one of this is when I would go out to Los Angeles, I would be like, everybody from Nashville is so nice. Everybody yeah. from that comes from, and we had a country music night on the dance show that I did, and Lauren, Elena, and Cole, and Lanco, and like all of us just hung out together the whole time.
Yeah.
And they're like, you guys all like know each other? You all hang out? And I'm like, you guys don't understand. Like,
yeah.
We're like this group. It's kind of like us against the world, we feel like, but in a great way.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of feel like we're all in this thing together.
Is that what the feeling? I don't know where how it developed. I don't know how y'all got like this.
I don't know about y'all. That's just but
but it's awesome.
I've been part of that too, where you go out and it's just like, oh well, we're a little different than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we like that about us.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah. When I go out, especially West, they're like, "What's wrong with you? Why are you so
that's
nice?"
So
and I'm like,
funny.
"Back home, I'm just a normal dude.
Yeah.
Out here, I'm the nicest guy. You give me
ribbons." That's good though. That's good. So was Blake like the second nicest guy out there?
Probably the biggest and not. You know what? When I used to do pop and hip hop, because I did that before I came over to country.
Oh, you did?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's how I started.
Oh.
I built a syndication company inside of doing pop and hip hop. And what happened?
I knew you liked hip hop, but I didn't know. Okay.
And
right.
I found this technology that would allow me to work on multiple stations at one time. And it's kind of a science experiment, right? That went right. And
wow.
I invested any money that I had at all into this and kept building it. But what had happened was I would stick Dierks on the air. Imagine Dierks Bentley on like a pop and hip hop station, right?
That's great.
Everyone would be like, what's happening? Willie would come through. I would put Eli Young Band on. They would come. And
oh
people would
God.
Go, what are you? Well, now I'm here doing country, and Ed Sheeran comes by, or mm-hmm. Pharrell comes by, and mm-hmm. it's the same thing, but people are like, well, what are you doing? That's so different, but it's always the same thing. Like, I've never been someone who is so inclusive to just thinking a format exists
yeah.
for the sake of a format, you know, where, you know, with me, it's been always about let me just get on good music.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I ended here, and you talk about you didn't come from country, but you were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're making vulnerable, authentic music.
Well, to you, it's all about the song.
Yeah, to me, it's all about, yes.
Which is that's the best thing. You know, I think songs are just one of those things where you can be a person that loves this genre of music and hear a song from another genre, and it just blows you away still. I mean, it's just a song is a song.
I don't even know what genres, I don't know what that means anymore.
Well, nobody wants them.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to, but you
just
know.
Just for classification purposes
mm-hmm.
only.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the only reason now.
Yeah.
Even the instrumentation. Like, I look back, because I would consider myself a novice historian of even country music. My
uh-huh.
grandmother, man, raised me on, like, old Andy Griffith gospel records.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the old, old school stuff. And
yeah.
for me, I'm from Arkansas, and Johnny Cash was big, not because he was Johnny Cash, but because he was an Arkansan. And there weren't a lot of people from Arkansas who launched on a national scene. So to her, he was everything.
Yeah.
And she would tell me stories about how he would play nearby and people would like pick at the shows because that wasn't country music.
Oh, wow.
Because that was rock and roll. That's not country music.
Yeah.
And then you look and I'd have a conversation with someone like a Garth.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go, people used to tell me all the time, I'm not country music. Like I came to town, he would say, they would tell me what I was doing wasn't country music because instrumentation, vocal style, it wasn't the same as it was before. And it happens again now. It's
mm-hmm.
happening now. People are saying, you know, insert whomever, XYZ is not country music.
Yeah.
And as much as you want to feel that way, my thing is, okay, let's just in a small bubble, you may feel that way now, but look at every single bubble over the past 6-7 decades when it's all exactly the same and the same people have the same argument. Here's the thing in common is that country music is always changing
mm-hmm.
and no one's ever, and if anyone ever becomes satisfied with it, then it's probably done.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I guess that's what music does is it, I think there's less of, you know, an artist makes a different kind of sounding record and people freak out. I think there's less of that. People sort of expect it more, I feel like.
I think
I
so
don't
too,
know.
Because again, we're not based regionally anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once Napster kind of hit,
mm-hmm.
the world changed.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we could just hit a button and have all the music we wanted.
Yeah.
And I mean, not good for people like you who would write songs and you mm-hmm. wouldn't get paid for those songs because Napster was amazing and free. But,
yeah.
You know, once Napster hit, we kind of had everything at our fingertips, where if you grew up like me in Arkansas, all the music stores had 80% country and then just the biggest and the biggest of the other formats,
mm-hmm.
where it limited your scope as to what you could actually consume.
Yeah.
Now there's no limit in scope.
Yeah, yeah.
And country music now is, I think, you talk about the songs, more about the message.
Yeah, it's more about stories
and
language that, you know, so I love pop music too, but sometimes those, if you just read those words, it would be very different than reading, you know, most of the writers I know, like we just did this today, like you read the lyric down and does it tell the story? You know what I mean? And when you get in the room with like Barry Dean or Tom Douglas or somebody that has one of those great voices and they read the lyric, like that's when you got to like, don't play or sing anything for a minute. Let's just read the lyric and see if it what it says to us. And I think country music still has a lot of, I mean, it's almost all that way.
I need to throw a commercial real quick.
It's a situation no one wants to experience during tax season, right? But with the breaches in the last couple of years, your information may already be exposed. And that could lead to an unfortunate discovery, finding out that a cyber criminal stole your identity and filed for your tax return. The good thing is, there's LifeLock with Norton to help you protect against things that could happen to your identity and your devices. If you become a victim of identity theft, well, tax-related or not, LifeLock will work to fix it with a dedicated identity restoration specialist who's assigned to your case from beginning to end. Plus, with the addition of Norton Security, you'll also have protection that blocks cyber criminals from stealing from your devices. Listen, of course, no one can prevent all identity theft or cybercrime or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can join right now and get 10% off your first year. I have it. I love it. It's helped me out before. Many times, actually. Just head to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LifeLock. Enter the promo code BONES. That's BONES for 10% off your first year.
Okay, so all of that, when we're talking about format and music and not really having a home, music doesn't have to have a home, right?
Mm-hmm.
I say all that because your song right now is at like number 2 from the Star Is Born soundtrack.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah. No, it's not crazy. It's not crazy at all.
Oh my God, it was such a crazy week. If you saw the way we wrote, you would know it was crazy. It was crazy that I actually ended up on anything on that, to be honest. It was so hard. It was so hard and so different and not what I do that it was such a blessing.
So what happened? I don't understand. What was so different about it?
Well, I've never... So what happened was Dave Cobb was working on that movie, mm-hmm. with... I think Bradley Cooper had reached out to him. And I remember we were making The Tree, and which Dave Cobb produced my last two records. And he was out in his truck in the parking lot at RCA, like talking to Bradley Cooper in his car, you know?
No big deal.
And I remember like teasing him about something, being late or something, kidding around. And he's like, well, I had to talk to Bradley Cooper about this thing. And then a couple months go by and he calls and he's like, I'm going to go out and do this film. And, you know, you should come and help write the songs, which I had never done before. I've read scripts before, but I think I've always sort of been rejected when I try to write something for something. I'm not that good at it. But this was a writing camp in a studio with Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and a full band. You know what I mean? And it's like, write the song, record the song.
I didn't know this is how this happened. So and you knew with the movie in mind what you were writing for.
Well, they were changing the script. Like, the script changed so many times. Just even from when I left that writing camp, the ending, I mean, it's pretty much the same, but it's very different than where it was going when we were in the room. But what happened was Dave called me and Hillary Lindsay, Natalie Hemby, and Aaron Ratier, and we went out there to write, you know.
For the movie.
For the movie with Bradley. And I didn't write with Bradley, but I think Aaron did, and Lady Gaga. And Hillary had worked with Lady Gaga on the Joanne record and, you know, sang with her a bunch. And so Hillary was familiar with the way she works. But to us, the rest of us, it was like this, you know, we had never met her. And it was just, for me, it's hard to, once you start a song, it's hard for me not to stop it until it's almost complete, or I feel like, oh, I've done everything I know how to do with this. And this was more like write an idea and then somebody, you know, because she's going from room to room and the band's there, and it was just kind of wild. It's a different way to be creative, but I hadn't had much experience doing that before. So I didn't know when I left, I didn't know that I had, you know, anything that actually make the film at that point, because there was so much still more to do. The script had changed so many times. The band had changed. Everyone, I left before everybody else. But it was just such a blessing, and the song came out so good. And it's funny because I remember writing that song, and we're in this famous studio, and the Foo Fighters were there. We were totally friends with the Foo Fighters for like a whole week.
Oh, they were there, like, physically, they were there.
They were in, like,
the
lounge beside us, and they would, like, come over and see if we had better cookies than they did. Like, literally. Like, I don't think, like, they knew any of our names, but we totally were friends for, like, a
were
week.
Were they nice?
So nice. Like, the nicest
people. Because I'm a massive fan. Like, Pat Smear, Taylor Hawkins, Dave Grohl, they were...
The nicest people
really?
You ever. The only problem I have with Dave Grohl is he, because I say my name is Laurie because I'm from Boston, and he was like, what is your name? So he thinks my name's Larry, but but literally we were like best friends with the Foo Fighters for a little while, and we would just write and write all day long, and then they would bring in food, and when we wrote the, you know, Always Remember Us This Way, there was like crying involved. There was like, you know, she got, Lady Gaga got so emotional with the lyrics of that song, and she was so in it that it was one of those moments where I left. I didn't know if it was going to make it, but I like just prayed to God that they would let something that vulnerable in, because she had been, she sort of just laid it all out. You know what I mean? Like she had put herself into that character so much, and it was clear even then, and they hadn't even started filming yet. So it was kind of amazing.
You sing background vocals in this song?
No.
You're not on this song at all?
I don't know who does. Yeah, no.
Let me hear this. When you hear the song the first time, is it during the movie or do you get a track first?
It's then during the movie when she performs by herself the first time on stage. But there isn't anything, I don't think there's any hints of it before that in the film.
What'd you think about it?
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like one of those things where I brought like my kids and my husband, you know, to the movie when it came out. Because I didn't miss the premiere. I was out in L.A. when the premiere here happened, so I missed it. But so I made the kids all come, and we all sat there and watched it together. It was great. You know what I mean? I thought the film was amazing. I thought, like, I just loved everything about it.
Do your kids think you're cool?
Hell no.
They don't?
No.
Even you're writing songs with Lady Gaga, you're... They still don't.
I cannot impress these children. Like, I literally... You know, when Tim McGraw sings something that I've, you know, been part of, that's the only way they'll listen to it more than once.
They don't want to hear you sing it. They just want to hear Tim McGraw sing it.
Yeah, they just all grew up with me, like, somewhere in the background. Like, you know how it is writing a song. You have to sing the same part over and over and over again. And they're just, like, over it. They're like, when is she going to cook us dinner?
Do you get to take them cool places? And they're like, okay, Mom. Sometimes they'll be like, this is cool,
yeah.
Mom.
Yeah, they definitely, you know, they've definitely benefited from the blessings of the music industry. And and two of my kids are songwriters, you know.
Really?
Now, so.
How old
two
are they?
Two of the older ones. My oldest is 29, and he's a songwriter. And my third, Christopher, is 25. He just moved to town, like, days ago.
Is there pressure that they put on themselves?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. What they do is very different. It's not really, you know, it's more pop, and they're in a band together, and what they do is very. I think that I think what they learned from watching my husband, whose name's Gene, you know Gene, and me, is that because my husband was always like, look at what you've done. You've ruined these kids. They're just going to, they're never going to make any money. They're just going to, you know, chase their dreams. But when you see someone come home every day and have a hard day, you know, my husband has a, you know, he's a plumber. He works for the gas company. And like, you know, like anything else, some of those days are going to be really hard. And when you see someone else just over there rhyming and like playing, like answering the door with the guitar, like, you know, it's like, they're like, it's not really me chasing my dreams that made them follow me. It's more watching him and being like, I don't want to do that. So I think, you know, we'll see what the young ones end up doing. But I think, you know, they've all grown up so much with music. Like, sometimes there'll be a writer in the basement, and I'll be like, dude, you know what that is?
And they don't, not that they don't care, but it's
like,
just normal.
Luke Laird's down there. He's had 23 number one songs. You know? And they're like, yeah, what? They can't be impressed. They can't. I've never, ever introduced, I don't think, my kids to, you know, one year we were at the ACMs, and we brought them to, like, the Luke Bryan party. You know what I mean? Nothing. I get nothing.
What do they like? What are your kids like?
They like country music. They really do.
Yeah.
But I just think they keep it all in check. And plus, they were a little sick of listening to me. So it all goes together.
You know what song you have that I really like that you guys, maybe you just didn't write it, but you just put it out. Speaking of Luke, was God of Country Music.
Oh.
You and Luke Laird, you wrote that together, right?
And Barry Dean.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was, this is emotional, this one.
So this is a George Strait song. Now, how does it get to George? Do you know you're writing it for George? I have so many questions about a George Strait song. How does this start? Are you just in a room and you just come up with the concept first?
So,
or do you know George is looking?
I think that for the most part, the publishers all in town know all that stuff.
Okay.
And so I write for Creative Nation. Luke Laird's wife, Beth Laird, runs Creative Nation. So I get, and Luke and Barry and I are dear friends. And so I have a day with Barry and Luke, and we're sitting up in Luke's office. And I know that probably Luke, you know, they send the list, you know, like these are the people that are looking, these are the producers, this is when they'll cut. But George Strait, it's hard.
You get a list of songs. Just so my listeners know this, because I've seen it.
Yeah.
But you're telling me there's a list of people who are currently looking for songs,
mm-hmm.
and you can go, okay, well, we can write something maybe sensibly this person would like a song like this, so why don't we aim it this direction?
Well, it doesn't tell you what the song is like. It just tells you...
But you know what the artist likes.
Yeah. This is the artist, this is the producer, this is when they should be cutting.
Right.
And those have always been around since I came to town. And sometimes they'll have more information. But for the most part, I don't even open those emails because I'm not really good at trying to go for an artist, especially if it's someone like George Strait that I've never met. Like, I don't really know how to do it. I have to kind of write from like a very self-centered, I guess, part. I don't know.
I wouldn't say self-centered. I would say knowledge of self.
No, thank you. That's a way better way to say that. Yeah, so the three of us had a date, and again, all songwriters have a list of titles in their phone, and I'm sitting there with Barry and Luke, and I said, I have this title, but I don't know how to do it or what it means. And I said, you know, God and country music, and Barry was sitting with his computer on his lap, and Luke was at his little rig with his guitar in his hand. And Barry does this thing sometimes where he'll just start typing away, and he disappears for a moment, not a long time. And he just sort of, when Barry does that, we all sort of know to wait a minute. And he said, well, it could be, because I'm like, I don't know. I don't even know why I wrote it down. I don't know where, like, what it means or what to do with it. And he's like, well, it could be, you know, like, you know, God and country music, you know, like whiskey and a prayer. And again, I swear to God, these crazy things happen to me. And like Johnny Cash's arm around Billy Graham. So in Barry's office at his house, he has that famous picture of Johnny Cash standing with Billy Graham. And it's one of, you know, it's a very special photograph for him. And as soon as you said that, Luke just swung around his chair and started playing chords. And he said, just do it again, but sing it. And he sang the verse. At one point during the day, I'm pretty sure Luke said, God, you know, it would be crazy. You know, it would be amazing if we could get this to George Strait. And so I don't know how they all did it. But that song, getting that cut and knowing how much everybody loves George Strait, but especially my friend Barry Dean and my friend Luke Laird, and how important that cut is to them, and because we love the song and we love each other, it's like when we heard that voice sing those words, it was like, you know, you can't you just gotta like thank your lucky stars for something like that to happen, you know.
That's so cool, especially because you appreciate it.
God,
you know,
I mean, I have to watch myself or I'll just start bawling all the time. I mean, I just can't walk around bawling all the time.
I would watch Luke Laird's Insta story, and you know, they'd be playing this when they came out, mm-hmm. and we were playing it on my show too, and I knew it was special to him because he had posted like three times,
yeah.
three different,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh, Luke,
yeah.
loves that George Strait. Who wouldn't love that George Strait singing your song? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, who wouldn't? Absolutely, but for the two of them, and they're besties, you know, they're best friends, and for the two of them, to have that moment to you know, together, me sort of be able to watch them, you know, be so thankful for that song and where it landed I can tell it's just gonna be a fun ride.
That's so cool. You know, when I like your music, you know, I just listen to your stuff. If I had to pick a song, because I was thinking about this.
Yeah, pick a song.
Well, because I'll post your songs on my Insta story too and be like, everybody should listen to this song. And I'll play on my show. I like, well, people when People Get Old came out.
Mm-hmm.
Thought it was such a... I don't think it matters what age you are. Like, you feel this song. You could be 16 and feel this song because there's a part of you that goes, oh, I'm watching all this stuff. Like, I'm 38 right now. And I'm going, oh, she's talking about me, my age. People get old. And it's just about how your life's all growing and changing and everything around you. I love this song. I love Wreck You.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I wrote that with Felix McTeague. Like, and that song was cut a couple of times.
By other
before me, yeah. Heidi Newfield cut that song, and David Nail cut that song. And David didn't put it out because Heidi did. She put it on a record, so David didn't put it out. But God, I love his voice, and I love both of them. But that song, I ended up cutting it. It was like 8 years old by the time I put it on The Bird and the Rifle, but because it was just one of those songs that just always came up as, like, people would ask me to sing it or something. It, like, just kind of wouldn't go away. It just wanted its own time and was happy to have it part of that record.
The Humble and Kind, you wrote by yourself, right?
Yes.
So you're sitting... I think that that's, like, one of the only songs in a long... Maybe Taylor Swift wrote Hours by herself. Mm-hmm. Like, there's only a couple of songs in, like, the past 10 or 15 years that have went number one that were written by a single person.
Yeah.
That's pretty freaking cool.
Well, that is cool, and it's funny because you would think it does happen more often, but I think that the part of the reason I love this town, and I don't explain this very well, but you know, I had maybe three or four, maybe more records out before I started coming. I guess three records out before I started coming to Nashville to write songs. So I had never co-written a song. Like, I just came up writing songs by myself. And at that time in the Boston community, there wasn't a ton of people that co-wrote. So I didn't know how to do it. And I didn't know, like, it just seemed so weird to me. Like, how do you pour your heart out and, like...
with someone else.
With someone else sitting on the other, you know, side of the room just staring at you. Like, how does that work? That seems crazy. And, but I will say that that's how where I found my community. Like, that's where I found, like, so I always explain it as some people are really great musicians, really great singers that can, like, play anything, sing anything. They know everybody's songs and they can, like, jump on stage and help you sing your song, help you, like, you know, tons of people like this. You're probably like this. Like, you can harmonize, you can, you know, just start playing along and, you know.
Like, Jake Owen is the best at that.
Yeah.
Right. Craig Campbell, guys, it doesn't matter what you're doing anytime.
They can do it. Right. And that's a big part of the Boston acoustic live scene. There's a venue there called Passim where we've all come up. It's like my home venue, and you see a ton of that. You just see, like, friends walking into the show, and then the next thing they're on stage, and they're all playing together. And it's this really nurturing part of music. It's really, like, where people, you know, the people that make the music really can connect that way. I've never been able to do that. I still don't know how to harmonize unless Hillary Lindsay teaches me how to do it. And so I'm really bad like that. So I was missing. I knew I was wrong. I knew I, like, wasn't 100%, you know, like, at all these things that everybody else was. And then when I found co-writing, I was like, oh, okay. So I can't harmonize to your song unless you teach me. But I can help you. Right. Like, I can sit here with you and try to help you write the best song that you can today, or the song that needs to come out of you. You know what I mean? Or the song that no one's going to hear, but you and I are like better for the experience of writing it just because we got something off our heart or whatever. Because, as you know, like, we all write a zillion songs nobody hears, but you have to be thankful for them because they get you to the one, you know, the one in 100 that somebody will hear. And that's where I really found my community. I think that's partly why I love this town so much, because I really, that's where I connect, is with my co-writers. So as much as I do write, I do like writing alone still. And sometimes I will have a title that I feel like, oh, I just, nobody's going to like this title. I'll just do it by myself. But sometimes I just really can't do it alone. I mean, by myself anymore. And I enjoy, you know, I enjoy that, the pulling it apart with a group, you know, with two or three people. It's great.
I was sent a list just now of other number ones in country music that have been written by one person. Okay. There are only a few. Taylor, Hours, Patsy Cline, Crazy. Do you know who wrote that? A little trivia. Do you know who wrote Patsy Cline, Crazy?
Was it Willie Nelson?
It was.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue. written by
Shel. That's Shel Silverstein,
yeah.
Right?
And Dolly Parton, 9 to 5. Dolly wrote by herself.
Wow. Mm,
those are the only other country songs
that's
written.
That's not true. Is that true?
Mike just sent me this list. Is that true?
I think that's all the big ones. There may be a couple more.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about this town, I mean, you can't really blame them because at any given moment, you know, like we could go down the street to a Starbucks, we'll probably bump into a great songwriter. So why not try to write a song together?
When you write, this is kind of a nerdy songwriting question for you, because I'll get in a room sometimes with people, and there are a couple kind of writers. There are writers that will go, that are very lyric based and very melody based. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, I have one friend who writes on melody first. So somebody will either play or a track will be built to write. Right. And she'll go, then you insert the words to the melody that's just been, or someone comes down with a bunch of lyrics and it's like, this is my idea, these are some of the couplets I have, this is where I want to go, mm-hmm. and then you build the melody around that. How do you walk and approach a write when it's just you? Are you lyric or melody?
I think I like to have a title. I love to have a title. I love titles, and I know some people don't like that, but I do love titles, and I think that's why a lot of us have just a list in our phone, but I think honestly the best thing in the world is if you can find them both at the same time. If you can find the melody and the lyric at the same time and they just pop out of your face, you know what I mean?
Then, well, that does sound easy. If I can just have them both and they pop out, Lord. This must be so easy for you. She's like, just have a number one fall out of your mouth, that's what I would recommend.
I think that's the way first. I guess I have to start. If I'm by myself, I have to start with words. But what I will do at home is maybe that's not true. Because what I do at home is I just play chords and I blah, blah, like your friend. And then you'll usually find the words that, you know, and if I can't, there's days that I just, you know, I'll try for an hour and I can't. I just end up hating myself, so I'll just put it away. I'm not an everyday writer. I couldn't write every day. Like,
oh, you don't write every day?
Oh God, I'm not that smart.
Man, I have friends that grind and they'll write two songs a day. You're talking about, you know, 4 hours minimally.
Yeah.
Twice a day.
At least. Phil Barton, hero. That guy, you know, and he's been to my house many times. And the thing about Phil is every time I picture him, he has a guitar in his hand and he's just playing another thing. And so, I mean, I think, you know, for the most part, I need to have a starting point lyrically in my head. I do love writing with track people where they'll play you something and be, but what I always ask myself is, what does that feel like? What does it feel like it wants? It sounds weird, but what does that feel like it wants to say? Like, is it like nostalgic? Is it, does it sound sad? Does it, you know, but God, that's why we love it. It's like, you never know what you're going to get into.
It's funny you bring up Phil Barton, a couple spins off of Phil. One, Phil and I wrote, I did a kid's record. I have a number one kid song. And Phil and I wrote it together with Eric Paslake called When I Grow Up.
And
he plays it and he'll go and do song writer rounds and he plays it and people will always send me. And I love Phil. He's got so much energy.
He's so great.
But did you guys write the Eli Young Band song together?
Mm-hmm. With Mike. Skin and Bones.
Skin and Bones. Yeah.
Yeah. And that started, I think there was like a little bit of lyrics, you know what I mean? And that did start lyrically, but, Phil's always, you know, when you just, the thing about co-writing is, and I always say this, is like, say there's three of us in the room, you know, some days you have an artist, so, you know, you're hoping the artist is the artist and you'll be the therapist or the best friend or the cheerleader or the editor, you know what I mean? Like, the thing that I love most about co-writing is you just never know in the room that day which hat you're going to have to wear. Like, I write a lot with Hillary Lindsay and Liz Rose. And even if we write several songs a day sometimes because we just camp out and spend like 3 days together. And sometimes even the song, like one song, Hillary will be the artist and I'll be the, you know what I mean? And we'll all take
you'll
it.
Switch roles.
Well, the next song, like we have something to eat and a glass of wine and all of a sudden next song is like, it's totally different. And Liz is the artist and you know what I mean? And we're trying to serve Liz and what she needs to have come out of her. And that's what I love about it. That's my favorite part.
Let me run through some of these songs real quick. I feel like we could talk all day, but I want to make sure some of these are highlighted. Let's see. I Want Crazy, Hunter Hayes. Look at this. Wrote this one. It's a cool one. right now. Let's see. I have so many. I mean, literally, I'm looking at like 50 songs here.
No. I don't think I even have 50 songs.
Look at all this. This is all a list of your songs I have right here. All on my little sheet. It's whatever I want to go to. You did Cry Pretty.
Oh, that was a joy. Yeah, that was a joy. She is one hell of a songwriter.
Carrie
Underwood. Oh, my God. And, of course, that was Love Junkies. That was me and Liz and Hillary. And Carrie came in, and she was just a love junkie for a couple of days. And we wrote a few songs. And when you see somebody, especially, like, you know, somebody that, an artist that big, when you, and I've met her a couple of times before, and she had cut another Love Junkie song, and she's been so good to us. But when she when someone like that comes in, that talented and that, you know, sort of exposed to the public and is that honest, it's just like, man, thank God, you know, like she's just listening to her in the room, especially with Hillary, because their voices, you know, are so beautiful.
Because they can both sing the crap out of words.
Oh,
both
my
of
God.
Them. They sing the crap out of words.
It's just like crazy.
My favorite Jillian Jacklin song, God Bless This Mess. It's my favorite song from one of my favorite artists.
She's amazing. Yeah.
Let's see. How about, I love Happy People. Felt like got the shaft. I don't know what, and I don't know. Every part of this song was fantastic. I tell you, I don't know what radio people do. I don't know. And I literally have the biggest radio show
so
in the history
weird.
Of the format of country music, and I have no idea how it works. Like the radio part of it, like the how the.
Honestly,
I don't like. I know. I'd
so
see
you just do your thing. You just do your. I kind of love that you, because I don't really know how the music business works. Our brain might get messed up if we learn too much about it.
I feel like if I learn the rules, then I play by them.
Oh, okay.
And so there are some that I kind of have to pick up along the way.
Sure.
But how that song didn't work. Happy People. Whatever makes you happy, people. And all the kids and all everybody's dancing. Every part of that was wonderful.
The video was great. I wrote that with Haley Witters, who's amazing, and she's an artist. And just check her out because she is amazing. And that was her idea. She showed up at my house, never met her. Well, maybe I had met her like for a second, you know. So I, you know, like you said, knock on the door, and I opened the door, and she said, I want to write a song called Happy People. And I was like, let's do it. You know, that was her vision. And
it was a wonderful song, let me say.
Yeah.
You got number one in my heart.
Thank you.
You met Oprah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about that real quick.
That was amazing. I went to be on the Oprah show because Faith pulled me in. And she was going to be on the show anyway. And the record was coming out, Fireflies. And she said, why don't I have my friend Laurie come up and we'll tell the story about, you know, sort of this, those being, you know, those songs coming from, you know, this housewife in Massachusetts. And sort of got to, what happened was, I was scared out of my mind. I was getting used to Faith, that, you know, I'd only been around Faith a handful of times at that point. But it was really, it was right after Katrina that they taped that show. So there was a lot of things happening in the background because Oprah was going to do a show down there, and she was doing all this fundraising and all this stuff. So there was a ton of watching, sort of these people pull together and help, you know, people in need. And it was, you know, we went to rehearsal the night before. Faith sang this, this gospel song called I Surrender All, I believe it's called. And we all just cried like babies. Like, Faith Hill is one of the most soulful people I've ever had the experience to know. And I've seen her in Monroe, Louisiana, sing a gospel song for a group of, you know, thousands of people that have been standing in a field for, you know, all day. It's a dry county. You know what I mean? They're just standing there. And she just shuts down the band for a second and starts singing. And everybody goes to church. Like, she is remarkable like that. So that was my takeaway. I had a couple of moments with Oprah just being so spiritual and so, like, sort of just big-hearted in watching them both communicate and how they were going to help people in New Orleans. And it was great. It was great.
Well, deflect, but you are so beloved in this town.
It's because I don't live here.
I don't think that's true. Listen, I'm going to say I'm so happy that you came.
Thanks for having me.
We've done an hour, and You know, you're one of my favorites.
Thank you so much.
I tell you that. You know that's true. And tell your husband I say hello.
I will. Well, he had a couple of things he wanted me to talk to you about. My mother-in-law says hello. This is a big deal for the McKenna family.
What did he want you to talk to me about? Something on mic or off?
Well, no, it was just like I left my ride, and I was like, I'm heading over to Bobby's. He's like, well, he's in a new house now.
That's true.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, do you know the address? And it was just so funny. He's like, well, I hope he's comfortable there.
I'm very comfortable.
You should be.
I'm very comfortable.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy. Listen, I could have a lot of other. We could do 8 hours of this. But how about in 2020, you come back and we'll do it again.
Okay, that'd
be great.
Go
over all your next set of number ones.
Okay.
And all the songs you've written, my favorite artist, that I'm like, I can't believe this wasn't number one because it was so good.
I know. And then we can still not know anything about how it really works.
And then we'll
works.
Be like, but do you know? No, I don't know yet.
I don't know either.
All right. This is episode 162, Bobby. Lori McKenna. And you can follow Lori on Instagram like I do. What is it? Just your name?
It's Lori McKenna Ma, M-A, from
Massachusetts.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
And my kids call me Ma.
But by the way, not Lori.
I know, I say it wrong.
I say L-O-R-I. Lori is how I'm from the South. I would say Lori.
That's how it's spelled. I'd say it wrong.
Do you love Aerosmith?
Yeah.
Being from Boston? Are they like a local, are they local feel to you?
Yeah, pretty much. I think they're like really nice guys. Like,
Steve and Tyler's super nice.
I told you my husband works for the gas company, and he's like, every now and then it'd be like he'll have to change a meter. And he's like, I'm changing the meter at Steve and Tyler's house. You wouldn't believe it. You know what I mean? I think that they're very sort of regular, you know, part of the community. People, I've never met any of them, but everyone loves them.
New Kids on the Block?
I don't know them either, but I bet they're super nice.
I just wonder who's like the big Boston group that you grew up listening to that was like the home team that made it.
Oh, geez.
Like the home that like my grandmother was Johnny Cash in Arkansas. When Bill Clinton made it, that was a big deal to us because it was somebody from like small town Arkansas that was president.
Yeah.
Who from around your hood?
I cannot think.
It's you. Maybe everyone waited for Lori McKenna to make it out.
I mean, it's gotta be New Kids on the Block, right? I mean, it's gotta be that. I mean, they're coming. I mean, they're all over the place right now.
Now they're like
It's the Wahlbergs. It's the Wahlbergs.
That's true.
The Wahlbergs are super nice, I think, too.
You ever met them?
Okay, no, but I was in the TSA line with the brother that owns a restaurant once, and I was watching him with his kids, and he seemed like a super nice guy. That's how I judge people. But Kay Hanley, do you know Kay Hanley? His letter's Cleo. Kay Hanley, she's out in L.A. now, and she does a bunch of stuff. But
what's letters of Cleo?
It's a rock band. Check it out. They're really it's probably 90s, like late
90s.
It's
not like Miss Cleo, the psychic.
No.
She's not from your hood.
But those Wahlbergs are hard to beat, you know.
We'll settle on that. The Wahlbergs are the most famous people to come from your hood.
I think the Kennedys and the Wahlbergs.
Oh, the Kennedys, of course. All right, episode 162 with Lori McKenna. Lori, thank you.
Thank you.